Welcome to Excite Beyond the Lab. My name is Ralf Tischlein, and today we are stepping out again of the lab to meet
Dr. Graham Andrews
and
Dr. Sarah Brown,
who are using the wonderful equipment.
The wonderful CT equipment.
Yes, to explore
the ability of a volcanic rock to absorb CO2.
Perfect. Tune in as we discuss how these tools help uncovering new insights about our planet right from the heart of our research environment. Dive into the practical side of science with us and see how the project Excite brings research to life. Now a brief advertisement. The Excite Network is a collaboration between 36 research centers in Europe, where we, with our equipment, have the pleasure to participate. It's supported by the EU. It helps scientists use advanced imaging technologies to study Earth and environmental materials like rocks, like in this case, and soils. And the network encourages scientists from different areas, such as geology and biology, to work together on projects that make the world better, step by step, I would say. And today, we are at the Center for Efficient High-Temperature Processes and Materials Conversion in Freiburg. And the Freiburg is this little city in Saxony, Germany, known for its deep mining history. And the city's university is the oldest university of mining and technology in the world. And it focuses on geosciences, material sciences, and engineering, and is well known for its research in sustainable and resource technology. And that brings me to you both, Graham and Sarah. Please introduce yourself.
Hello, I'm Dr. Graham Andrews, and I'm with my wife and science partner, Dr. Sarah Brown, and we've got the pleasure of being here with Ralf in Freiburg to help us study a type of volcanic rock called basalt. Anyone that's been to Iceland or Hawaii will be familiar with it. That's the black rock that you will see forming from the volcanoes. And we're interested in how that rock, which is a natural way for the Earth to absorb CO2, could possibly be enhanced in geoengineering as a way to help address climate problems. My background is as a volcanologist, so I come at it as someone who has studied volcanoes and volcanic rocks. And I'm interested in taking sort of that background and applying it to geoengineering.
Yeah, Sarah?
I am originally from Chicago, in the States, and my background is looking at the structures in geology and dating them, and last couple of years I've been looking more at CT imaging of materials to try to understand how they better work, and I am coming for this project for mainly from the background of having some CT use.
That's very nice. I have prepared something. Honestly speaking, it took a while, you know, both that we assembled all stuff. And I have brought something with me. Maybe you will guess maybe what it's... I can give it to you, Graham. And then I have another one in our... We have actually prepared our podcast mics on a sample container here. On a container containing all stuff we use for sample preparation usually. And in the bottommost part, there is something hidden to our guests. I will open it now. And please, Graham, could you give me the device here? And I will make a sound, and you could probably say to me what this sound may have, what is the relation of this sound to your research? I literally opened a bottle of Freiburger Citroen Radler beer, 0.0 because we are at university, and I can drop some. It's also a nice sound. Yeah. And could you please comment on that, if what this sound may have connection to your research?
So you hopefully heard the sound of a bottle being opened, and it's a nice fizzy bottle of alcohol-free beer. And as you know, that fizz comes from carbon dioxide that is dissolved in the liquid that's in the bottle. So even though you cannot see the bubbles initially, you know it's there. You know the difference between when you taste it, if the bubbles are and the CO2 is there or it is not there. And you know that if you shake it up too much, it will foam and you will make a mess. So the geology and CO2, carbon dioxide, that we know is one of the principal causes of heating of the atmosphere and of climate change are intimately linked. The biggest store of carbon dioxide on Earth is actually in the interior of the planet, in the mantle. And volcanoes do release CO2, but they release the same amount of CO2 over time, over all of geological time. This does not really change. The big difference in the last 150 years is the amount of CO2 that humans have released. But in the same way that rocks can store CO2 deep down and can release it, they can also absorb it back in. So in magma that's coming from deep in the mantle and erupting from a volcano, there is CO2 initially dissolved, just like in your bottle of beer, your bottle of cola. And when you release the pressure and have a volcanic eruption, the CO2 exsolves and forms bubbles. And that makes the whole mass, it makes it foamy and bubbly, so it becomes less dense, and it rises. And as it rises, the pressure is less, so it exsolves more and the bubbles grow, and it becomes less dense again, so it rises faster. And this keeps happening. It keeps rising, becoming less dense. Bubbles expand, less dense, therefore it rises. That keeps happening until you have your big volcanic eruption. And that's what gets magma from deep down in the beneath the crust to the surface. It's the power of this dissolved gas, which is usually either dissolved water, H2O, or carbon dioxide, CO2. And in some cases, that CO2 and water are trapped within the rocks, and there are ways that geologists can analyze that. And there are others where that is released into the atmosphere. And ultimately, that's how Earth's atmosphere was formed in the first place. Because when the Earth was initially formed, it was a big sphere of molten magma with no gas atmosphere. And as it cooled, it released that gas, and then gravity allowed us to hold on to it. So all the planet's gas was initially in rocks and released that way. And then you imagine a rock that has these bubbles in it. This magma has the bubbles. It looks like a sponge or a foam. As it cools, it will solidify and it will keep those bubbles in it, those holes. So you end up with this rock type called basalt. It's dark grey. It's very rich in iron and magnesium and calcium. And it has lots of empty round holes in it. The technical name is vesicles, or vesicles, but they are bubbles. And we can now use those bubbles as a space to try and put CO2 back into from the atmosphere. So the analogy with beer or with cola is good because we're looking at how you have a liquid and you have gas. And sometimes the gas is dissolved in liquid, sometimes they exsolve, so you have the bubbles. You can see bubbles bursting, you can see bubbles forming. The only difference is that in a magma, it then will solidify to form a rock, it freezes. So if you imagine, taking your beer and freezing the foam head, you would have something that looks like your volcanic rock. And that's what we want to target to put CO2 back into.
Oh, that sounds very nice. The question when we are dealing with X-ray tomography are also always samples and different sample sizes. Could you comment on what are the sample sizes? And because of high resolution, for high resolution, we need very, very tiny samples, maybe 1-2 millimeters in diameter. How did you get the samples? And maybe comment on the places where you collect the samples and why.
Okay, yeah.
Not in total detail, but why? Yeah.
So we have samples from two parts of Europe, one from Northern Ireland and one from off the Atlantic coast of Norway. And they've both been selected because they are potential places where CO2 could be collected and stored underground in these basaltic rocks. Northern Ireland samples were originally collected during oil exploration in the early 1990s. But to get down to the potential oil-rich rocks, which turns out they were not oil-rich, they had to go through this basalt layer. So they have they collected little tiny pieces, maybe half a centimetre, and smaller sizes of rock from the basalt. And we are picking out the very, very smallest, sort of less than 1 millimeter, maybe half a millimeter sized pieces of those for our analyses here in Freiburg. The samples from Norway come from the Integrated Ocean Drilling Program, IODP, Expedition 396, where a drilling ship, the Geordie's Resolution, so basically a sort of big commercial type ship with a drill, massive big drill on the back, but purely for scientific research, drills into the seafloor, and it collected those basalt rocks along with other things, and then we were able to take tiny pieces of those, of that, all that sample that was collected and is stored in Bremen.
And the original mission was to explore such potential places where CO2 can be pressed underground, or was it only a site?
It was a secondary target of that project. The primary project goals were to study how continents break apart. So Norway, about 60 to 55 million years ago, Norway and Greenland would have been joined together, and there was no North Atlantic, there was no Iceland. So as they split apart to form the Proto-Atlantic, magma rose from the mantle, and the first bits of ocean crust are what we sampled as the basalt. You can think of it as the very, very first earliest expressions of the continuing volcanism in Iceland. And the secondary goal was to study the climate changes that happened at that time. There is, in the geological timescale, we have two periods called the Paleocene and the Eocene, at about 45 million years ago or so, 45 to 50 million years. And that is a period when the North Atlantic opened, but also a period when the temperature on Earth, both the temperature of the atmosphere and the temperature of the oceans, increased dramatically, increased maybe half a degree centigrade per year at most, maybe like 0.1. But at a rate far faster than even climate change now, the fastest increase ever recorded in the history of Earth. And it actually caused the last significant mass extinction event where many species went extinct. And one of the...
Before the asteroid impact.
After the dinosaurs and the
after
asteroid.
Yeah.
So the dinosaur impact was about 66, 65. This is about 45, 48, something like that. There's long been thought about how this was done, because at the same time, along with this temperature increase, there was a big increase in the amount of methane in the atmosphere and in the oceans. And methane is a very powerful greenhouse gas, much more so than CO2. So it is thought that somehow there was this huge release of methane into the atmosphere, somehow, and that caused extreme global warming over a very short period of time, and a very short period of very high temperatures. So this area was selected because it has a good record of the sediments that were deposited at this time, and it tracks also the microorganisms that lived in the oceans then. So you can see some that were doing fine, and then the temperature increases and they go extinct.
Okay. Yeah.
And ones that were very small, insignificant, suddenly become the dominant species. One of the results seems to be that, and this was published in 2024, that that there's a link between the plate tectonics, the volcanism, and this methane and climate change, where the heat from the magma, so plate tectonics is pulling the plates apart, that creates space for the magma to come up. The magma came up into ancient organic rich deposits that maybe a couple of hundred million years old, organic rich deposits, and it heated those up and it released methane from those deposits that then went into the atmosphere. So you're sort of the volcanic rocks were cooking the surrounding seafloor and releasing that methane to the surface, and then it poisoned the atmosphere. So there's this potentially this nice link, and we even preserve some little fossil basically vents or volcanoes where you can see that there were huge bursts of methane. That came out sort of one at a time and actually caused explosions on the seafloor as they released all of this. So so the Integrated Ocean Drilling Program always has sort of one or two big key goals and then has two or three secondary goals. The basalts that were drilled, the secondary goal was obviously the CO2 storage into them, because this area is adjacent to a soon-to-be-opened Norwegian gas production area, where the companies producing that will look to store some CO2 to offset the CO2 that will be produced.
Maybe before coming to this, because I think it's a very important thing, the thing with the CO2 sequestration in terms of the mineral carbonization, because before you came here, I read something, I would not say a lot, but something about it, and when I talked to you both, then I thought it's totally different than I thought, because I thought it's like pressing CO2 in the ground, and it stays there as a gas. And as we discussed previously, there are techniques where it is like that. But every time I thought, how would that work if they press it, and then they push something in that it's not coming out again? But the mineral carbonation thingy is some totally different thing. And I got the idea when we stood in front of the CT and we are looking at the reconstructed slices, and you said, oh, we are looking if there are some nice tiny structures appearing. Could you comment on this, that it's how this mineral carbonation works in easy words? Because I think this is a very important thing, and I did not know that.
Yeah. So as you say, Ralph, the sort of the industrial process is to collect CO2 and use pressure to pump it underground, into areas that had previously had oil and gas in them. There's an alternative where we use rocks that like volcanic rocks that were not productive for oil and gas in the past. And it actually involves a chemical reaction. So rather than using pressure just to keep the CO2 in, you're actually forming new minerals that are locked in for geological time. The rock type basalt is particularly good for this because, like I said earlier, it's rich in magnesium, iron, and calcium. and they bond very easily with carbon dioxide to form minerals called carbonates, which is any mineral that has the composition of a metal like Mg and then CO3. So you take a molecule of magnesium oxide or calcium oxide and some CO2, and they will bond together, and it's a very efficient, easy chemical reaction to occur in nature. It does not need any extreme temperature or anything. So this happens naturally at the surface of the Earth, but it will speed up if you can introduce CO2 to rocks, especially if they are deeper down where it is a little bit warmer, and the process will happen faster. So in this process, which is currently, it is not experimental, it is currently done at industrial scale in Iceland at a project called CarbFix, which I encourage anyone to go and look at. It's fascinating. But they take CO2 from the atmosphere, they combine it with water, and in doing so, they make a very weak acid. So the water becomes slightly acidic. They then pump that into the rocks, and that weak acid actually attacks the rocks, and it extracts magnesium, calcium, and iron from the basalt. So now you have this dissolved magnesium, calcium, and iron, and you've got water that is rich in carbon dioxide, so then you begin to make new minerals. So what we're seeing in our scans from the CT here in Freiburg is we're seeing we're capturing the first step of that, certainly, where there are tiny cracks in the rock, only like a couple of microns long, fractions of a micron wide. But we're seeing these tiny cracks, and some of the minerals next to those cracks, particularly a calcium-rich mineral called plagioclase, where the mineral meets the crack, it has changed. We see it as a color change, as a change in the grayscale, but that looks like what geologists call a reaction rim. It looks like we're seeing where a chemical reaction has happened. In this case, where calcium has probably been extracted from the rock into that crack during the initial experiments, and we're seeing that part captured. The next step would be to hopefully see new crystals of carbonate grow, but it's a dissolution and precipitation process. You dissolve rock and then you make new rock. I think we're definitely seeing the dissolving of the old rock, and the next step is to see the precipitation of new rock.
When you're talking about some nice structures we saw in there, we also see some very nice structures which are perfectly related to the winter season, I think. They are looking like a leaf or like ice crystals forming. Could you comment on this? Because I thought they were very nice.
Yeah. So one of the unexpected things we got from the very first scans, we keep seeing, is a particular type of crystal structure that I would say it looks just like a snowflake or maybe a Christmas tree. If you imagine how a child would draw a Christmas tree, usually we think of minerals as being squares or rectangles or like being shapes, being polygons, but this is very much like a series of lines when seen. It's a mineral called olivine. It's a very important mineral in Earth. It's probably the most common mineral on Earth. It's important in basalts, but normally it forms a nice green, sort of round, glassy mineral. Looks like a piece of broken beer bottle. But in cases where the magma was very hot and then erupted very quickly so that it cooled down, went from 1300 degrees centigrade to, let's say, 1 if it erupted on the seafloor in a few minutes or an hour or two, then that decrease in temperature so quickly prevents the crystals from growing nicely, making nice, large crystals like you would want to make jewelry from. Instead, you get these skeletons of crystals. The technical name for this is hopper texture, after, I guess, a Dr. Hopper, who described it first. But it produces these beautiful three-dimensional Christmas tree patterns or snowflake patterns, because you're seeing it grow the skeleton of a crystal, but it has not filled in the spaces between the edges. Or if you want to think about it as like nodes of a structure, it's sort of growing the nodes and the joins between the nodes, but it leaves the open framework behind. And in the CT images, these look absolutely spectacular. They look beautiful.
It's actually, there's a very, very nice samples, almost these little tiny ones, because often or sometimes we have one-phase particles where we want to see cracks, or we want to see the morphology of the particle, surface texture, something like this. Or, in other cases, maybe two-phase components, but like this, that you have varied in one larger particle, different grains with a different morphology and stuff. It was very special to see. It's a very nice sample, yeah. We have to come to an end, but I think we can make a second talk, maybe after a third call or fourth call meeting or something.
Maybe.
And my last question would be, imagine if your sample could talk, what do you think it would say after weeks of swimming in a small reactor, where it always is reacting with CO2, what do you think your particles would say?
Well, I always think of rocks as being how happy or unhappy they are. The happy rocks tend to look nice and clean, and they look simple. Unhappy rocks are very grungy. They look unhappy. They're full of cracks and they're different colors. These basalt rocks, these basalt rocks want to be in the mantle. They don't want to be on the surface of the earth. They want to be the original magma wants to be like 1,500 degrees C, 40 kilometers below the surface, back in the mantle with its brothers and sisters and cousins. Instead, it is on the surface of the earth for 45 or 50 million years, and it's experienced seawater, it's been rained on, it's been snowed on. When it erupted out of a volcano, it lost some of its gas. It got ripped out, it got melted and ripped out of the mantle very, very quickly. Then sat on the seafloor, then a ship came and drilled it, or on land it was drilled out. And then, to add sort of insult to the injury, then we put it in bottles with water and CO2. So we're subjecting it to acid. We're giving it an acid bath. And for several weeks, and then we're putting it into a radiation source and bombarding it with X-rays. Like, it is very unhappy. We are torturing this rock. It is having a very, very bad 50 million years. What it wants is to go back to the mantle. It wants to melt and go back, which is impossible. It is the Earth system in that sense is a one-way system. Yeah. So ultimately, the rest of the rock that is still out in the wild outside will be rained on and snowed on. It will dissolve naturally. It will break down into smaller and smaller pieces until it is no longer recognizable as a volcanic rock. And eventually it goes into the oceans and dissolves away. That is the fate of most rocks. they will dissolve. The exception is rocks that contain the mineral quartz, because quartz will not dissolve easily. That's why when you go to the beach is made of quartz. Everything else dissolves away.
That's
so you look
that's at, very interesting.
Yeah, that's one of the cool sort of things about geology is like when you go to the beach, it's always quartz because everything yeah. else dissolves away and just leaves the quartz behind.
So, and
then I guess if you really take it over hundreds of millions of years, it goes into the seawater, it will react with what's dissolved in the seawater will react with the ocean floor. It might get subducted back into the mantle. But now you're talking about an individual atom of magnesium that has taken 300 million years to go all the way around to finally be back where it's happy. So the fate of a volcanic rock is not a happy one. But this one is contributing to science.
Yeah.
This is a good sacrifice.
This is a good thing. So thank you both for your visit here. It was a great pleasure for me to meet you, Willy. It was a great pleasure. And also that you are interested in doing the talk with me and stuff. It's very cool. And thanks for listening. And yeah, stay curious and stay excited.
Good.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
It was really good. Really nice.